What does it take to be a con artist? Good looks? Charm? Grace? Or is the key to swindling coming up with a story so outrageous no one even thinks to question it? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I went through a very brief and specific shoplifting phase in my teens, but I am generally bad at theft. Once, a bank teller gave me $20 too much, and I returned it to her immediately. One time, I literally forgot to pay for my groceries. I have no idea how or why the checkout person didn't notice, but I realized the error when I got home, went back to the store, and paid. Everyone looked at me like I had two heads. Call it a moral failing. In theory, I really want to stick it to the man, but in practice, I realize it's probably a woman who's going to get in trouble for it. For miscounting the 20s or letting four bags of groceries walk out the door for free. The subject of today's episode did not have that same moral failing. She had no qualms about being a thief. She took what the good Lord gave her, which many reporters were quick to point out were not good looks, and turned herself into a millionaire with other people's money. Elizabeth Betty Bigley was born in 1857 on a small farm in Eastwood, Ontario. She was the fifth of eight children. According to a piece for the Smithsonian Magazine titled The High Priestess of Fraudulent Finance from 2012, Betty lost her hearing in one ear as a young girl and as a result developed a speech impediment. Like many others with irregular speech, she learned to cope by speaking very little and choosing her words carefully. She didn't fit in at school. Quote, her classmates found her peculiar, and she turned inward, sitting in silence by the hour. One sister, Alice, said Betty often seemed to be in a trance, as if she had hypnotized herself, unable to see or hear anything that existed outside of her mind. Coming out of these spells, she seemed disoriented and bewildered, but refused to discuss her thoughts. End quote. Stranger, my girl was dissociating. The article goes on to note that Alice, quote, noticed her practicing family members' signatures, scrawling the names over and over again, end quote. Contemporary news accounts were quick to point out that Betty was a, quote, woman without physical charm, as a piece from Maclean's in 1949 put it, or not especially beautiful, as the Chicago Tribune worded it in 1936. The Tribune piece also said that, quote, as a girl, she exhibited a mania for fine clothes and jewelry. I'd be interested to know what the Tribune might have considered a mania to be, and if they would have used the same word for a boy who was crazy about baseball or something. Anyway, Betty was exceptionally bright. But rather than apply her smarts to honest work, like so many subjects of this show, Betty decided her talents would be best applied to theft. While most of her peers were busy playing stickball or learning how to sit in a way that would attract the most men, Betty was figuring out how to separate people from their money. At 13 or 14 years old, Betty forged an inheritance note. According to the piece in the Smithsonian, quote, the forged notification of inheritance looked authentic enough to dupe a local bank, which issued checks allowing her to spend the money in advance. The checks were genuine, but the accounts non-existent. After a few months, she was arrested and warned never to do it again, end quote. A piece from the Western Reserve Historical Society notes that Betty was released on the grounds of insanity, but the piece offers no details on said insanity. It's hard to imagine a 14-year-old having to plead insanity over writing some bad checks, but I wouldn't put it past Ye Olde Times Canada. Betty's next scam that we know of happened in 1878 when Betty was 22 years old. A piece from the Clinton Republican out of Ohio in 1929 reported that on November 21st of 1878, she went to a barber in Brantford, Ontario and had her hair cut short. She then asked the barber for a false mustache. The article continues, quote, "When at length she sought to raise money on a gold watch, the police were called in. Her father was communicated with and she was taken home," end quote. I don't know what that means or what on earth the false mustache had to do with any of it. Maybe she tried to pawn the gold watch while wearing the fake mustache? I don't know. Anyway, it turned out that by then, Betty was carrying business cards she'd made that read, "Miss Bigley, heiress to $15,000. Spoiler alert, she was not an heiress to anything. But Betty knew that she couldn't just claim to be an heiress. She had to act the part. So, according to the Clinton Republican, quote, "She bought $250 worth of dry goods with a note endorsed by a wealthy farmer near Branford. She also purchased an organ from E.J. Thomas of that city, giving her note in part payment," end quote. Stranger, when I first read that sentence, let me tell you, I was confused. I was like, you're just going to casually drop in there that she was going around buying organs? I had completely forgotten in that moment that there is also a musical instrument called an organ. I'm fine. Betty paid off that first note with another forged note, and it was that forged note that landed her in jail again. Once again, she pleaded insanity and was released. Now that I'm saying it, I think the Western Reserve Historical Society may have gotten its dates mixed up. I think it's more likely she pleaded insanity at 22 than at 14. I think at 14, she probably got a slap on the wrist and a warning. And at 22, she pretended to be loony to avoid jail time. Whatever the case may be, it worked. Betty was acquitted. She learned her lesson and went back home to the farm and lived out the rest of her life as a law-abiding citizen. LOL, JK. This lady was just getting started. Strangers, you know I'm serious about sleep. My bedroom is as dark and cool as a cave. I have my favorite pillows, the perfect comforter, an eye mask, and a green noise machine. But the cherry on top is my Miracle Made sheets, which help keep me as cool as a cucumber, while my husband sleeps all layered up and cozy like a bear. In the same bed. Is it magic? No, it's science. Miracle Made sheets are made with silver-infused fabric from technology inspired by NASA. The fabric helps regulate your temperature, so whether you sleep hot or cold, you'll be comfy all night. Miracle Made sheets also help prevent almost 100% of bacteria growth. With Miracle Made sheets, you can feel confident that you're only snuggling with who you want to snuggle with, not with germs. They help prevent colds and help keep your skin clear. What more could you want from your sheets? Upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use the promo code STRANGE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/strange, code STRANGE at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Two years after pleading insanity to get out of jail time, in 1880, Betty was living in Cleveland, Ohio, with her sister Alice and her husband. And by 1882, she was up to her old tricks. This time, according to the high priestess of fraudulent finance, quote, "While Alice thought her sister was seeking a job at a factory or shop, Betty was roaming the house, taking stock of everything from chairs to cutlery to paintings. She estimated their value and then arranged for a bank loan, using the furnishings as collateral," end quote. When Alice's husband found out about Betty's little scheme, he was like, nope, and kicked Betty out on her ass. But Betty fixed that problem by marrying Dr. Wallace S. Springsteen on December 3rd, 1883. But after a local paper ran an article about their nuptials, a slew of people showed up at their doorstep to demand the money Betty, now Mrs. Dr. Wallace S. Springsteen, owed them, including her own sister. Dr. Springsteen hired private investigators and learned that his new wife was not who she said she was. He learned of all her previous schemes, and 12 days into their marriage, he divorced her. Oddly, though, he didn't divorce her on the grounds that she'd lied about her past. he divorced her on grounds of infidelity. Whether or not she was actually being unfaithful or that was just the term used for lying, I don't know. Shortly after the divorce, according to the Cleveland Republican, quote, Dr. Springsteen received a letter from a Buffalo attorney informing him that Mrs. Springsteen was stopping at one of the best hotels there and that she had empowered him, the attorney, to draw $6,000, $195,000 today, on Dr. Springsteen on the grounds that she had submitted to a separation. The doctor immediately denounced her as an imposter, end quote. Betty lived for a short time at a boarding house using the names Madame Rosa and Mrs. Scott. But then, in 1884, she popped up at a hotel in Erie, Pennsylvania, where she collapsed from a hemorrhage of the lungs. And when the kindly strangers around her came to her aid, she was like, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed. I am a very wealthy woman. I live in Cleveland. I just need enough money to get back there." And they loaned her a bunch of money. When they came back asking for repayment, they received a letter telling them Madame Rosa, to whom they'd loaned their money, was, sadly, dead. According to the High Priestess of Fraudulent Finance, the notice came with a beautiful tribute to Madame Rosa's life. She was, of course, not dead. Betty Bigley was alive and well and living in Cleveland under the name Madame Marie LaRosa. Apparently, she was now calling herself a clairvoyant and charging people to see their futures, which no doubt included emptying their pockets into her coffers. She then married her second husband, a farmer named J.R. Scott. There's not much information about this marriage, except that it only lasted a few months, and at the end of it, Betty owned Mr. Scott's farm. Sometime in 1885, she married again, this time to a wealthy local businessman named C.L. Hoover. And it was around this time that she began using the name Cassie. In 1886 or 87, she gave birth to a son, Emile, whom she promptly sent to Canada to be raised by her family. Hoover died in 1888, leaving his widow with an estate worth $50,000, a whopping $1.7 million in today money. Betty, widowed and free of the burden of raising a child and extremely heavy of pocket, lived quite high on the hog. By 1890, she was in Toledo, Ohio, as Madame Lydia DeVere. According to the Clinton Republican, quote, she could be seen in the finest of carriages driving about the city, and her entertainments were known as elaborate, the cost of flowers alone being high, end quote. It was at this time that Betty began separating men from their money. According to a piece in the Washington Post from 1904, titled Miss Chadwick, the High Priestess of Fraudulent Finance, not to be confused with the piece in the Smithsonian with virtually the exact same title from 2012, quote, notes aggregating $40,000 to which the name of Mrs. Blythe of Cleveland was signed brought about the trouble. Joseph Lamb was an express clerk, married, and father of five children. He said he met Madame DeVere and visited her at home. Soon afterward, she told him she needed money to go to Philadelphia. She wanted $1,500, and Lamb raised it by giving her his savings of $1,000, besides $100 cash he had in hand, and his note for the balance. She returned to the city after a week and began asking him for more money, end quote. Both Lamb and Betty were arrested, but Lamb was like, I'm not guilty, I'm just gullible. He actually claimed not guilty by reason of having been under her hypnotic influence, and he was acquitted. Betty, on the other hand, was sentenced to 9.5 years. She served about 3.5 years before being paroled by then-governor and future president McKinley. The only thing of note that I could find about her stint in prison was that while there, she was still claiming to be clairvoyant, and she predicted that the warden would lose $5,000 in a bad business deal and that he would die of cancer. Both of those things came to pass. Following her release from prison, Betty moved back to Cleveland and began living under the name Cassie Hoover. And here, sources differ slightly, with a couple claiming she worked as a sex worker, while the majority claim that she actually became the madam of a brothel. Regardless of her role, it was at the brothel that Betty, now Cassie, met her fourth husband, Dr. Leroy Chadwick, whom she married in 1897. According to Oberlin's Mysteries of History, quote, when the famously rich doctor entered the brothel, Bigley introduced herself as a widow who had recently taken on the position of the manageress of this home for girls. When Chadwick clarified that this was not a home for girls, but a house of very ill repute, Mrs. Hoover fainted and asked the doctor to take her away from that place, end quote. I love this story so much. This wealthy doctor comes in and she's like, I'm so goodly, I'm helping these poor girls in need. And this guy was like, LOL, this is a brothel, and she fucking faints. Ma'am, what did you think the men who came and went all day were doing? What did you think all the money was for? Why did you think there was so much laundry that needed doing? When Dr. Chadwick announced his sudden engagement to Hoover, his friends were like, who dis? The lady that runs the brothel? You met her at the brothel? And he was like, no. I mean, yeah, but like, I didn't go in there for sex. I went in there for a massage, you see, for my rheumatism, because, you know, I'm a doctor and a massage is definitely the cure for rheumatism. And this nice lady, who, by the way, had no idea she was working at a brothel, offered to give me a massage and it helped my rheumatism. So I'm marrying her. The newly anointed Chassie L. Chadwick, no one knows what, if anything, the L stands for or why she chose it, wasted little time in spending her husband's fortune. According to a piece in the Chicago Tribune from 1936 titled Queen of Swindlers, quote, Mrs. Chadwick proceeded to convert the old Chadwick home into a palace. This conversion eventually costing $200,000, $6.5 million today. She furnished it lavishly. She covered the walls with expensive oil paintings. Every floor had a soft, expensive rug. Chairs and tables were of quaint, antique design. Everywhere were ornaments of gold. One could not walk through the house without colliding with some piece of valuable bric-a-brac. Clocks were everywhere, big, medium, and small. Mrs. Chadwick had a mania for clocks. Carvings and statuettes filled a half dozen Watteau cabinets. On a certain Christmas Eve, she took her husband to the theater and supper. During their absence, a corps of decorators completely changed the interior of the home. On their return, Mrs. Chadwick said to her startled husband, "This is my Christmas present to you," end quote. But this was not even Betty Bigley's biggest con. The best was yet to come, and it was epic. Strangers, I am obsessed with my dogs, but let me tell you, I have never known anyone more obsessed with their dogs than my bestie and her husband. These two spend hours every day talking about their dogs. They get photo shoots with their dogs, throw them birthday parties, write them songs. It's wild. That's why I told them about Ollie. My dogs love Ollie. Ollie's recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. Ollie is obsessed with making the best meals with the highest quality ingredients. From the moment you start your subscription, everything is tailored to your pup. The meals are perfectly portioned, and you get a pup-tainer and scoop for easy storing and serving. With Ollie, you don't just get food. Through their app, you can actually check in on your dog's health with real vets. Just by uploading a picture, their team can check in on your dog's weight, digestion, teeth, and coat. Does your dog food do all that? I don't think so. Get ready for both you and your pup to be obsessed. Head to ollie.com/strange, tell them all about your dog, and use code STRANGE to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today. Plus, they offer an obsession guarantee. If you're not completely obsessed, you'll get your money back. That's ollie.com/strange and enter code STRANGE to get 60% off your first box. Ollie, feed the obsession. There are two versions of how Betty Bigley, now Cassie Chadwick, pulled off her most famous swindle. Both versions appear in contemporary sources. I'm going to start with the really fun version. According to the 1936 article in the Chicago Tribune, sometime in 1902 or 03, Cassie, on a trip to New York City, asked her husband's lawyer, Mr. Dillon, to accompany her on an errand. She had a package to pick up, she explained, from Mr. Andrew Carnegie. Yes, that Andrew Carnegie, one of the wealthiest men in the country, and probably the world. You see, she said, she was the niece of Frederick Mason, who was an associate of Mr. Carnegie. And as the Tribune explained her story, Mason, quote, had left her $7,500,000. Mr. Carnegie, as executor, had pyramided the fortune to nearly $11 million by judicious handling. Now he wanted to shift his trusteeship to a reputable Cleveland bank, end quote. They pulled up to Andrew Carnegie's palatial home on Fifth Avenue, where Cassie told Mr. Dillon to wait in the carriage while she went in. Later, Dillon would not be able to recall if he saw her actually go inside or if she stood just outside the threshold. At any rate, he saw Cassie chat with a housemaid, and after about 20 minutes, she returned to the carriage with a small package, which she said held, quote, $2,500,000 in Caledonia Railroad bonds and various notes and deeds signed by Mr. Carnegie, end quote. The article continues, quote, then in a simulated burst of confidence, Mrs. Chadwick confessed that she really was Mr. Carnegie's daughter, that the name Frederick Mason was a blind to protect her, and that the $11 million estate would be hers in 1907. And now, don't tell a soul, she begged. End quote. Mr. Dillon returned to Ohio, where he set up a safe deposit box for the package Mr. Carnegie had given Cassie, and then proceeded to tell anyone with ears what Cassie had sworn him not to. This was, evidently, all part of Cassie's plan. According to a piece about the case on the website Women in History, quote, eager bankers began offering her loans of up to $1 million with interest rates of 25%. Believing millions were available to be gleaned. Instead of demanding repayment, they let Cassie's loans compound annually, figuring Carnegie would vouch for any debts and they would get their financial rewards after probate. According to one source, her husband was with her when she placed the promissory notes in the safe deposit box at Wade Park National Bank in Cleveland. End quote. The less fun version of this story does not include the trip to Mr. Carnegie's mansion and instead had Cassie going to Irie Reynolds, secretary treasurer of the Wade Park Banking Company and a friend of her husband's, with a promissory note for $500,000, apparently signed by Andrew Carnegie, and the sealed package, which she said held stocks and bonds equaling $5 million. A later account from the Sarasota Herald Tribune from 1955 says she claimed the number to actually be $7.5 million. Reynolds was hesitant to sign off on stocks and bonds and notes inside a sealed package, but Cassie apparently said, "Do you doubt my word?" in such a haughty tone that Reynolds was like, "Okay, okay," and handed her a signed receipt for $5 million. Whichever of these two versions is more accurate, the result was that word quickly spread around town that Cassie Chadwick was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie, and bankers bent over backwards to lend her money at astronomical interest rates. Cassie was cunning. She knew that men generally thought women weren't smart, so she used that to her advantage by offering lenders bonuses. According to the piece in the Chicago Tribune from 1934, quote, for a $25,000 loan, she'd offered a $5,000 bonus, 20%. How could the money lenders resist? They couldn't. She was known among them not as a good risk so much as a good thing, and they played her, not knowing she was really playing them, end quote. When she did repay loans, it was with money she'd borrowed from somewhere else. She worked over a dozen banks in this way. She got C.T. Beckwith, president of Citizens National Bank, to grant her a loan from the bank of $240,000 and then an additional $100,000 from his own personal account. She borrowed $800,000 from a Pittsburgh steel mogul whom the Smithsonian piece described as, quote, likely an acquaintance of Carnegie's. Herbert Newton, an investment banker in Boston, loaned her $79,000 from his business and somewhere between $25,000 to $104,000 from his own personal finances. In her IOU for this money, Cassie promised to pay him back with enormous interest. He was so excited at the prospect of making money on the deal that he never stopped to question any of it. While all her lenders were waiting for their investment to pay off, Cassie was busy spending their money as if her life depended on it. According to the Clinton Republican, quote, one of her favorite pastimes was to walk into a store and ask to see diamond rings. It might be that the clerk would place before her one or more trays of the baubles. These look nice, she would say, indicating with her finger an entire row of gems. I think you may give me those. And she would leave the store carrying in her muff enough jewels to pay a year's rent of a Fifth Avenue mansion, end quote. She must have had one big muff. Cassie also apparently bought no fewer than 8 grand pianos as gifts for friends. She paid for them all in cash. To her credit, Cassie wasn't just buying diamonds and pianos, though. She visited a Cleveland toy store just before Christmas and pulled out a list that store clerks said was 2 feet long. When she was presented with the $800 bill, she paid it without a second's thought. She had the toys delivered to various orphanages and children's wards in local hospitals. She made it clear that the recipients were not to know from whom their gifts were given. She did not skimp on herself, though. She spent lavishly on her own home furnishings. According to the piece in the Smithsonian, those purchases included, quote, a perpetual motion clock encased in glass, a $9,000 pipe organ, a musical chair that plunked out a tune when someone sat down. She had a chest containing 8 trays of diamonds and pearls, inventoried at $98,000, and a $40,000 rope of pearls. She ordered custom-made hats and clothing from New York, sculptures from the Far East, and furniture from Europe. Even when purchasing the smallest toiletries, she insisted on paying top dollar. If a thing didn't cost enough to suit her, one acquaintance reported, she would order it thrown away, end quote. My husband briefly worked for a billionaire and was instructed to throw away any loose change he found in the house. But one cannot go on buying diamond-encrusted pianos for every person in the great state of Ohio on someone else's dime forever. And, as I'm sure everyone was acutely aware of Cassie's lavish spending, her creditors were eventually like, bitch better have my money. But of course, bitch did not, in fact, have any of their money anymore. Cassie Chadwick's spectacular run ended in November of 1904 when Herbert Newton, the investment banker from Boston who loaned her up to $104,000 of his own money, filed suit against her for the $190,800 she had promised him. Two other bankers then came forward and were like, hey, us too, and sued for a combined sum of almost $70,000 in unpaid loans. According to the Sarasota Herald Tribune, Newton refused to say whose signature was on the original $500,000 promissory note Cassie had shown him as proof of her wealth. It was, of course, Andrew Carnegie's signature, which I'm sure Newton had by then not only realized was a forgery, but was mortified that he had ever let himself be pulled into this ridiculous ruse in the first place. In response to the accusations, Cassie turned around and was like, I never said I was the illegitimate daughter of Andrew Carnegie. I don't know what these dudes are even talking about. Which is like, girl, what? Then why is his signature on those notes? Strangers, these days I'm all about quality over quantity, especially in my closet. If it's not well made and versatile, it's just not worth it to me. That's honestly why I love Quince. The fabrics feel elevated, the cuts are thoughtful, and the pricing actually makes sense. I love everything I've gotten from Quince, from their Mongolian cashmere sweaters to their basic black tee to the French terry wide leg pants that I can wear casual or dressed up. Quince makes high-quality wardrobe staples using premium fabrics like 100% European linen, 100% silk, and organic cotton poplin. Lightweight cotton cashmere sweaters perfect for the changing seasons, and can't-miss seasonal colors and prints for spring. Versatile, well-made pieces that make getting dressed simple. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman. You're not paying for brand markup or fancy retail stores, just quality clothing. Quince clothing is consistently rated 4.5 to 5 stars by thousands of customers. Real people wearing these pieces every day and actually loving them. Right now, go to quince.com/strange for free shipping and 365-day returns. That's a full year to wear it and love it. And you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't keep settling for clothes that don't last. Go to quince.com/strange for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/strange.
Why have I asked my electrician I found on Angie.com to bury my pet hamster Nibbles in our yard for me? Because I was so moved by how carefully he buried my electrical wires, I knew I could trust him to bury my sweet Nibbles after his untimely end. Nibbles, gone too soon. May he scurry in peace.
Hey, sorry about your pet, but I just wire stuff.
Nibbles would have loved you like a brother.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
It is difficult to say exactly how much money Cassie Chadwick, nay, Betty Bigley, stole. But one estimate from the Wall Street Journal in 1904 puts the number at $19 million, about $600 million in today money. The Smithsonian says the most commonly cited number is $633,000, which seems to me to be a gross underestimation given her proclivity to spend. The Chicago Tribune put the number she stole at $1.5 million, nearly $50 million today. That seems a tad high, but don't forget she was buying whole trays of diamonds, or, as one newspaper man put it in 1949, quote, her jewels were what one might expect, dazzling. A rope of 240 pearls was known to have been appraised at $40,000. Whole trays of crusted gewgaws were bought from local jewelers whose jaws dropped at her imperious, I'll take them all, end quote. Crusted gewgaws sounds like something you'd hear on the pit. Patient presented with crusted gewgaws with secondary signs of crinkly doodads. It's all fun and games now, I guess, but at the time it was neither fun nor a game, especially not for C.T. Beckwith from Citizens National Bank, who had loaned Cassie $240,000, almost $8 million today, which was four times what the bank even had. The bank had to close its doors. Beckwith had also loaned Cassie about $100,000 of his own money, which, of course, he would never get back. He told the New York Times in 1904, quote, it is bitter to think that everything is lost. Oh, the pinching and the squeezing of the last few months, all to get money. No one can ever know of the torture of it all. Personal property was swept away, the savings of years. But what of that, if only the bank where my friends did business could be saved, end quote. And it wasn't just that he'd lost all his money and forced his own bank to shutter, but C.T. Beckwith was named in the suit. He died before the trial began, probably as a result of the incredible stress of the whole thing. A.P. Spear, the cashier who'd signed off on the loans, was also named. Cassie's fourth husband, remember him? Me neither, was also charged, even though he'd apparently been in Paris the whole time. I don't know what that was all about. Maybe he married Cassie and then was like, oh no, what have I done? And instead of divorcing her, just booted himself off to France. He, of course, denied knowing anything about his wife's activities. And what about Andrew Carnegie? Turns out no one had bothered to look into Cassie's story that he was her father. When they finally did, Carnegie himself didn't even bother to comment. Instead, he had his secretary speak for him in a statement that read, quote, Mr. Carnegie has never met Mrs. Chadwick to his knowledge and does not know her. He has, for a number of years, made a practice of never giving his signature to notes of any description. He is certain it is not on these notes, end quote. For her part, Cassie faced the charges head-on by fleeing to New York. She tried dodging the law and the throngs of reporters by flitting back and forth between various hotels. She was arrested on December 7, 1904, while ill in bed at the New Breslin Hotel. She was sent to jail, where she was apparently considered a suicide risk because she was not allowed a fork and knife, but had to eat with a spoon. A serious downgrade, I would imagine, from the literal ruby-encrusted silverware she was used to. According to the piece in the Times, Cassie's lawyer was like, "I don't know what the fuss is about. Cassie is a very rich woman and could pay her creditors." I mean, okay, then why didn't she? When asked about the allegations that she forged Carnegie's signature, her lawyer's response was that he was, quote, "not familiar with Mrs. Chadwick's loans in the West." Isn't that what this entire thing is about? What other loans are we talking about, sir? Andrew Carnegie, despite his efforts to keep himself removed from the whole hullabaloo, was subpoenaed and testified that the notes and signatures were forged. Quote, "If anybody had seen this paper and then really believed that I had drawn it up and signed it, I could hardly have been flattered," he said, pointing out errors in spelling and punctuation. "Why, I have not signed a note in the last 30 years. The whole scandal could have been avoided," he added, "if anyone had bothered to ask him," end quote. Okay, so remember the package that Cassie claimed to have picked up at Carnegie's mansion on Fifth Avenue? The one she challenged Irie Reynolds, her husband's close associate and the secretary of Wade Park National Bank, to open if he dared doubt her story? The one that was supposedly filled with $5 million worth of stocks and bonds? Reynolds finally dared to doubt Cassie and opened the package in late December. What he found, according to the Chicago Tribune, was, quote, "no stocks or bonds, only four worthless pieces of paper. One was an alleged trust deed for $10,240,000 bearing Mr. Carnegie's purported signature. One was a copy of that deed. Another was a promissory note for $5 million bearing Mr. Carnegie's forged signature. The last paper was an $1,800 mortgage against Daniel Pine belonging to Dr. Chadwick." When Mr. Reynolds saw the papers, he gulped, "so much brown paper." He was asked what that meant. "Brown paper is cheaper than white," he replied enigmatically, end quote. The trial began on March 6th, 1905. Cassie did not testify. After 6 days of testimony and just 5 hours of deliberation, the jury found Cassie guilty of conspiring with President Beckwith and cashier A.B. Speer of the Citizens National Bank to withdraw more funds than the bank even had in its coffers. Beckwith was dead, but Speer served 5 years for the crime. What's wild to me about Beckwith and Speer being found guilty is that, sure, they signed the checks, but they didn't get anything out of it. It's bad enough to commit fraud and then go spend the money lavishly. It's a whole other thing to commit fraud and end up walking away with nothing but personal financial ruin. Before he'd died, Beckwith defended himself by saying that he'd done his due diligence on the loans. Cassie, he said, swore to the signature's authenticity in front of him and two whole other people. Also, it turns out Cassie hired a lawyer, or someone pretending to be a lawyer, to show up and claim that he was Andrew Carnegie's lawyer and that the signature was indeed authentic. I didn't dig into that story, and I do wonder why that guy wasn't named in the suit. If anyone was colluding with Cassie, it was that guy. Strangers, I don't eat a lot of red meat, but when I do, I want to know that it's clean and sustainable. For over a decade, ButcherBox has led the industry with meat and seafood that's antibiotic-free, hormone-free, and independently verified. It's the clean, trustworthy protein you want to be eating, especially at the start of a new year. With ButcherBox, every product meets the same rigorous standards, whether you're cooking a filet mignon or popping chicken nuggets into the air fryer. It's all quality across the board. ButcherBox has made it so easy to keep our freezer stocked with high-quality protein for every night of the week. The chicken breasts are delicious, the prime rib steaks were a huge hit with my kid, everything we've had from ButcherBox has been so tasty. ButcherBox delivers over 100 premium protein options straight to your door, including 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork, and wild-caught seafood. As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between organic ground beef, chicken breast, or shrimp in every box for a year, plus $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/unexplained. That's right, your choice of organic ground beef, chicken breast, or shrimp in every box for an entire year, plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/unexplained. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. Cassie was sentenced to 10 years in prison and a fine of the equivalent of $2.3 million today. According to the Chicago Tribune, when her lawyer told her the verdict, quote, she flushed deeply, raised a hand to her head, and sank into her chair. As she was being led away, she cried, "Let me go. Oh my God, let me go. I'm not guilty. I'm not guilty, I tell you. Let me go." She became hysterical and fainted, end quote. According to one account, she went into hysterics for a good 15 minutes before being led to her cell. Prison, as I'm sure you can understand, stranger, did not suit Cassie Chadwick. She struggled to make the adjustment from a life filled with diamond-crusted gewgaws to whatever deplorable conditions existed in a turn of the 19th century Ohio prison. Without her grand pianos and fur rugs, Cassie lasted a little less than 2 years. She rapidly lost a lot of weight, and by October 10, 1907, she was in a coma for some hours before dying quite alone. The Clinton Republican reported that no friends or family came to her deathbed, and that her son, Emil, who had been summoned, arrived 15 minutes after her death. Cassie was 51 years old. Who knows if she went on an intentional hunger strike or if she actually became ill. She was a woman who knew what she liked and was used to swindling people to get it. I'm sure there was a matron or two she could bribe for a few comforts, but still, an austere life behind bars was a far cry from what she had grown accustomed to. Andrew Carnegie, though, was still alive and felt terrible for Cassie's victims. According to OhioHistory.org, he gave money to citizens who'd been affected and, quote, refilled Oberlin College's coffers. I have no idea how Oberlin College got involved, but when the president of the college went back to New York to thank him, Carnegie gave him more money for a library, which stands to this day. Who knows why Betty Bigley, aka Cassie Chadwick, chose the path she did? Plenty of people with hearing loss and/or speech impairment have chosen more lawful lives. Plenty of people who are withdrawn and shy have chosen more lawful lives. Plenty of women who weren't stunners even have chosen more lawful lives. And it's not like Cassie was a toad. She wasn't walking around looking like Sloth from the Goonies. I mean, she did end up snagging 4 different husbands. Cassie Chadwick never opened up about the why of it all, but perhaps in a time when options for women were extremely limited, when our job prospects were paltry, when we couldn't own property or have our own bank accounts, Cassie solved an unjust problem in unlawful ways. Perhaps she saw herself as a victim of an unfair system and tried to rectify it by collecting her own victims. If the world wasn't going to give her what she wanted, Cassie Chadwick was going to take it. The tremendous irony is that men have been pulling off all kinds of scams since the dawn of commerce. There have been so many of them, indeed, from small-time hustlers to Wall Street titans to kings and presidents, we've almost come to expect it. In a world of scammers, Cassie Chadwick has lots of company, but in a world of women scammers, she stands practically alone. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, In 1991, three innocent young girls at the very start of their lives were gruesomely murdered in a yogurt shop in Texas. And in a story that's all too familiar, four boys got swept up in the investigation with no proof or evidence of their guilt. The Texas Yogurt Shop Murders. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Gourdette. Sound mixing and design by Jeff Devine. If you have an idea for an episode or want to submit a question for an Ask Me Anything episode, head to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Eventually, I need an assistant. You can follow me on social media at Daisy Egan or follow the show at SNU Pod and Grab Bag Collab. Stay strange.